Welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, July 27th, 2020. I'm your reader, Alan Frederick-Hill, substituting for the usual Monday reader, Bart Knepper. Here's a look at what I'll be reading today. First, I'll take a look at the weather, then the mini editorial, then front page and inside stories of local interest. About 20 minutes after the hour, I'll read letters to the editor and editorials. And at 30 minutes past the hour, I'll read the obituaries. After that, it will be feature stories, sports, and other stories as time allows. First, here's the weather, and then the mini editorial. Well, the weather today is a little bit of improvement from all the heat. It's the high of 86 with light winds from the north at 4 to 8 miles per hour, down to 62 tonight with the winds about the same but switching to the southwest. Tomorrow, Tuesday, up to 88, partly sunny, nice in the afternoon. But the wind comes back up from the southwest at 7 to 14 miles an hour. 65 on Tuesday night. Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, all partly cloudy with highs of 86, 83, and 82, and lows over the night of 66, 60, and 58. There's no wind in the forecast to speak of. Possible thunderstorm maybe Thursday and Friday, but doesn't look like there's going to be too much. The sun rose this morning at 6:13. It'll set tonight at 8:50 p.m. Tomorrow, Tuesday, it will rise 1 minute later at 6:14 a.m. and set 1 minute earlier at 8:49 p.m. And now for the mini editorial. And this comes to us today from Julie Carter of Lawton, Iowa. And Julie says, 25th Amendment. Enough said. Well, for those who haven't looked it up yet, the 25th Amendment says that in case of the removal of the president from office or of his death or resignation, the vice president shall become president. Now for the lead story, and it is, after waiting nearly four extra months, Jordan Henry will have his day in court this week, charged with fatally strangling a woman in a Sioux City hotel room before setting fire to it. Henry is scheduled to stand trial Tuesday morning in Woodbury County District Court. He has pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder and first-degree arson. Henry, 30, of Sioux City, has waived his right to a jury trial, and District Judge Stephen Andreasen will hear evidence and decide the case. If found guilty as charged, Henry would face a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole for murder and 25 years in prison for the arson. The trial had been scheduled to begin in April, but was continued after Iowa Supreme Court Chief Justice Susan Christensen in March ordered trials across the state to be delayed in order to avoid large gatherings and slow the spread of the novel coronavirus. Christensen last month ordered that in-person court hearings could resume as of July 12th, but jury trials will not resume until September 14th. Henry is accused of strangling Elizabeth Bockholt, a 40-year-old mother of four, on January 24th, 2019, in a room at the Wingate by Wyndham Hotel, and then attempting to burn her body by setting fire to the room. Police and firefighters found the Hinton, Iowa woman unconscious when they responded to the fire at the hotel at 4716 Southern Hills Drive. Attempts to resuscitate her failed, and she was pronounced dead at a local hospital. Henry was arrested about a half mile away by officers responding to a call of a suspicious person in the area. He was identified as a suspect from surveillance video and by witnesses who saw him leaving the scene just after the fire was discovered. According to court documents, Bockholt and Henry had been romantically involved before he was sentenced to prison in March 2017 for theft, but Bockholt voluntarily went to Henry's hotel room the night of her death, 8 days after Henry was released on parole from prison, the investigation found. Public defender Billy Oyedare has filed a notice that he plans to use defenses of insanity and intoxication at trial, and an expert witness is expected to testify in support of that defense. The trial will be conducted in accordance with procedures newly enacted to reduce the risk of exposure to COVID-19. Andreasen, Oyedare, and Assistant Woodbury County Attorneys Mark Campbell and Jill Esteves will wear clear plastic face shields. All others in the courtroom will be required to wear a mask or other face covering. Media and others attending the trial must sit at least 6 feet apart. Henry's case will be Woodbury County's first murder trial this year. The most recent murder trial was in September of last year when a jury found Elmi Saeed, who was charged with second-degree murder for fatally stabbing his roommate in a Sioux City apartment, guilty of a lesser charge of voluntary manslaughter. Saeed was sentenced to 10 years in prison. And in a year far from typical, Sioux City kindergarten teacher adjusts curriculum plan. Walking into her classroom for only the second time since Iowa schools were closed due to the COVID-19 concerns in mid-March, Yesenia Macias was busy counting llamas and unicorns. The Irving Dual Language Elementary School teacher explained that the animals, one of which is real and the other one mythological, are her class's unofficial mascots. Indeed, llamas and unicorns in the form of plush toys, art pieces, or drawings had been pushed into the corners of Macias's classroom after building maintenance people began cleaning carpets. So were desks, chairs, and other items needed to teach kids. Most years I would already be in the classroom preparing for the school year, said Macias, who was in her fifth year at Irving. However, this isn't our typical year. By the time Sioux City Public School students are scheduled to return on August 25th, the old rules may not apply. Due to social distance requirements, I don't know if the kids will be working on the floor, at desks, or on top of yoga balls, Macias said. To be honest, I'm not even sure if arts and crafts will even be allowed right away. Such concerns are especially important for kindergarten teachers, since they are also teaching social skills to students who may not have had any prior classroom experience. We teach them things like reading body language or identifying emotions by looking at a person's face, Macias explained. This isn't easy when a person is wearing a mask. In addition, kindergarten teachers want to make sure students start the school life on a positive note. Macias will be one of the speakers for a virtual bilingual teacher conference that will take place online Wednesday through Sunday. She will be helping fellow educators understand social-emotional learning, which can have a profound impact on kids. Such learning requires input from other teachers as well as the families of students. This input wasn't available when schools closed their doors last spring. However, Macias is looking forward to collaborating with her colleagues once again when school begins. We are training for the 21st century, and that requires plenty of collaboration, she said. That means teachers collaborating with teachers and students collaborating with each other. So what will happen if schools need to close and learning must be done online? Macias said students, even in kindergarten, are surprisingly internet savvy. I know some students who already want to become YouTube stars, she said. But what if some families don't use resources like the internet or computers? Macias tells parents they don't need to worry. We'll drop off school material ourselves, she explained. We are willing to make a special delivery to the homes of our students. Macias pulled out her favorite book from a shelf. It is El Monstruo de Colores, which is translated as The Color Monster by Anita Yanis. Subtitled A Pop-Up Book for Feelings, the story identifies certain colors with a corresponding emotion. For instance, yellow represents happiness. Blue is sadness, red is anger, black is fear, and green is calm. Macias is looking forward to plenty of yellow and green days for the upcoming school year. The photograph accompanying the article shows teacher Macias as she prepares her classroom. And then the next lead story from the front page of the journal is that the Sioux City Council is to consider contracting with a private firm for airport management. The Sioux City Council on Monday will consider contracting with Colorado-based firm that would take over some management responsibilities at the Sioux Gateway Airport. The contractor, IAAC LLC of Aurora, Colorado, would provide regular on-site guidance and oversight for airport operations, maintenance, procedural development, training, and FAA Part 139 requirements at the city-owned airport, according to the city documents. The city would pay IAAC $8,333 per month during the one-year contract. IAAC is a provider of airline, airport, and air traffic control consultants, according to the firm's website. For airlines, IAAC boasts on its website that it can reduce operating costs by increasing efficiency through personnel and equipment enhancements, while for airports, the company focuses on increasing safety and improving efficiency. City Manager Bob Padmore said the airport has been without a dedicated airport manager since about 2008. For several years, that role has been filled by Assistant City Manager Mike Collette. Collette would oversee the contract with IAAC if the council approves it. Padmore said the city is seeking a seasoned and experienced airport operator, and IAAC can provide one quickly. The airport manager, Padmore said, would look at a possible reorganization of the airport's operations, focusing on things like staffing and maintenance. Sioux Gateway has had some stumbles in recent years. Last December, the FAA proposed to levy a $145,000 civil penalty against the airport for numerous alleged safety violations found during airport inspections in May 2018 and June and September 2019. This year, the number of people boarding flights at the airport cratered due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Some flights this spring left the airport with fewer than 10 passengers. Padmore said the city is not currently looking to turn over the airport's entire operations to IAAC, the way Spectra Venue Management effectively took over the Tyson Event Center, Lock, Stock, and Barrel, but he added that he couldn't rule it out either. I don't think anything is out of the realm of possibility. The photograph accompanying this article shows the takeoff of an American Eagle flight bound for Chicago as it rises off the runway on July 21st at the airport. Sioux City Council on Monday today will weigh whether to hire an outside contractor for airport management services at a rate of $100,000 per year. The photograph also shows a lot of construction equipment in the photograph, which of course doesn't work well on a runway, but in fact, this is because they are repaving one of the intersecting runways, which is known by pilots as 1836. That means it runs north-south. Turning now to Inside the Journal, a study seeks silver buckshot for farmers. Lisa Schulte Moore wants to get Iowans as excited about anaerobic digestion as she is. Like I said, I like a good challenge, the Iowa State University professor says. The professor of natural resource ecology and management has $10 million in 5 years to work on her challenge, courtesy of a federal grant to develop new ways of turning biomass and manure into fuel. U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Institute for Food and Agriculture will fund the Consortium for Cultivating Human and Natural Regenerative Enterprises, or CCHANGE, to create solutions to economic, environmental, and ag industry challenges. At the same time, the research could lead to what Schulte Moore calls new value chains, the generation of renewable natural gas, stronger rural economies, and better protection of the environment, including water quality. Schulte Moore, 49, Associate Director of ISU's Bioeconomy Institute, will lead the consortium of ISU, Penn State, and Roseland Alternative Energy of St. Louis in looking for ways farmers can use their resources more efficiently, all while being profitable and protecting the environment. Farmers, you know, their identity is to produce stuff, to grow things for markets, she said. We recognize the benefits of current production systems, but also that there's a lot of inefficiency in how we use land, sunlight, nutrients, and water. So I'm coming at it from sort of the agricultural end of things, looking at how do we use our farm environments in ways that make sense from the standpoint of maintaining profitability, but also to address the significant environmental concerns, said Schulte Moore, who has worked with farmers on incorporating native grasses and cover crops into their practices. It's not just the issue of what to do with the manure from intense livestock production, but also about improving water quality and wildlife habitat while reducing soil erosion, nutrient runoff, and flooding. The question is asked of her, this seems like a broad project involving three institutions, people from academia, as well as the private sector. Where do you start? Her answer is, you do your homework, Schulte Moore said, adding that the project doesn't start from ground zero. There's been a lot of research done on incorporating anaerobic digestion into farm operations in Europe. There, individual farms may have a digester, or, because the farms tend to be smaller, a group of farms share a digester. The research partners each bring something different to the table. Penn State has worked with Pennsylvania farmers who make greater use of digesters than their Iowa counterparts. Roseline is partnering with Smithfield Foods to address manure issues at the company's pork production facilities. And I'm coming at it from the agro-ecosystem side in an effort to help farmers create a market for perennial crops grown on parts of their farms where the soil and landscape are less suitable for row crops, Schulte Moore said. The next question, what are we talking about when we say anaerobic digestion? Her answer is, it's the process by which microorganisms break down biomatter and produce biogas, which is mostly methane, the main component of natural gas. Schulte Moore explained that with new separation technologies, biogas can be upgraded to renewable natural gas and distributed through the gas pipeline network, much like renewable electricity is distributed through the power grid. Anaerobic digestion is common in processing municipal waste, and Schulte Moore sees a possibility cities could expand their facilities to capture economies of scale and become more efficient by handling manure or biomass from farms. Another possibility would be to co-locate digesters with biofuel plants that would process the material and use the natural gas in ethanol production. That would help them lower the carbon intensity scores associated with ethanol, she said. But the next question. You're talking about solving a lot of challenges farmers and rural communities face in being economically and environmentally sustainable. Are you searching for a silver bullet? Her answer is, the better analogy is we're putting together a bunch of silver buckshot, Schulte Moore said. We're putting several pieces together, some things that we already know work, like the integration of native grasses, the prairie strips. We know that cover crops work. We know about anaerobic digestion as a technology associated with manure, and it works. So what that allows us to do is, hopefully, be better able to hit the target, because we're throwing a whole bunch of things at it, some of which we already know we work really, really well and already are doing. While the individual pieces work well by themselves, what we're trying to do is put together a system that's going to be a real winner and make a meaningful difference. And the Missouri River Historical Development Incorporated Group, or MRID, has an online-only COVID-19 relief grant application process, which opens today. Missouri River Historical Development, Inc. is opening the online application process on Monday for organizations to request grants to help them respond to emergencies created by the novel coronavirus. Grant funds must be used to provide direct relief and/or services to individuals who have been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic, according to the MRID press release. Woodbury County-based nonprofit groups and government entities are eligible to apply. The maximum individual relief grant is $25,000, and a total of $150,000 in awards will be announced come October 22nd. The public will be notified of the presentation details at a later date. Nonprofit or government applications in counties outside Woodbury County, which include Plymouth, Ida, Cherokee, Crawford, and Monona, must show how their project will benefit residents of Woodbury County. Application forms may be requested at MRIDiowa.org through August 24th. Proof of nonprofit status is required, and telephone and mail requests will not be accepted. Completed grant application forms will be due by 5 p.m. on September 8th. Requests for grant application forms require submission of a copy of each organization's 501c3 determination letter from the Internal Revenue Service. Government entities must submit a letter from their chief operating officer indicating the entity has board approval to request grant applications and to receive grants. Organizations that received grants in the traditional spring-fall grant cycle during the last 12 months are still eligible to apply for these emergency grants. Recipient organizations that have not completed a project funded by MRID grant before 2019 are ineligible unless they submit their report documents. MERD, which is a nonprofit organization founded in 1989 when Woodbury County voters approved a referendum that sanctioned riverboat gaming, controls the license to conduct gambling in the county. Currently, the license is held by the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Sioux City. That organization has distributed or pledged nearly $40 million in grants since 1994. The latest Woodbury County Court report. Before Judge Stephen Andreasen, Darius Liddell Triplett, 30, of Sioux City, was charged with first-degree theft, assault while participating in a felony, assaulting, causing bodily injury, and was convicted and sentenced July 23rd to 16 years in prison. Jesse Gerald Marshall, 38, of Sioux City, was charged with possession of a controlled substance, third offense, trespassing, and was convicted. His sentencing was July 22nd for 5 years in prison, but it was suspended with 2 years probation. And Christopher Donald Jones, 29, of Sioux City, was convicted of possession of a controlled substance, third offense, and sentenced on July 23rd to 5 years in prison. David Robert Mott, 30, was convicted of domestic abuse assault, impeding breathing, and sentenced July 22nd. He received a deferred judgment and 2 years probation. And Autumn Rose Block, 23, of Sioux City, was convicted of eluding possession with intent to deliver a controlled substance and was sentenced on July 22nd to 10 years in prison. Brian Lee Rose, 34, of Sioux City, was convicted of possession of a controlled substance, third offense, sentenced on July 21st to 5 years in prison, of which it was suspended but with 2 years probation. Jean Lynn Parker, 53, of Winnebago, was charged and convicted of possession with intent to deliver a controlled substance and sentenced on July 20th to 10 years in prison, which was suspended with 3 years probation. Angel Gerardo Castillo Martinez, 20, of Sioux City, was convicted of possession with intent to deliver a controlled substance, a drug tax stamp violation, and assault on a peace officer. He was sentenced on July 16th to 15 years in prison. And finally, Ricky Joe Brown, 45, of Sioux City, was convicted of enticing a minor and was sentenced on July 20th to 5 years in prison, but which was suspended with 3 years of probation. Well, I know I said earlier I'd be reading opinion page and letters to the editor, but apparently there is no opinion page on Mondays. At least there's none today. So we'll continue with some stories. And this one is that the pandemic has buoyed boat sales. Brandon Mitchell had big plans to visit family in Michigan and take his wife and 3 kids to Disney World, but the pandemic put those plans on ice, so they bought a boat instead. "We're going to take to the sea. There's so much to explore," the ebullient skipper said. "It'll get us in the recreation and escape mode that we're not going to be able to get anywhere else." A growing number of people like Mitchell, who plans to spend the remainder of the summer island hopping along the Maine coast, are looking to the water amid the coronavirus pandemic, and that's good news for the boat industry. From Maine to California, boat dealers are reporting unprecedented sales that began in the spring in warm weather states before picking up steam in other parts of the country, like Maine and Minnesota, later. Marinas and boat repair shops are swamped by the wave of interest. There are also waiting lists for slips for boats. A recent survey showed more than 70% of boat dealers were either completely out of boats or had low inventory, said Matt Gruen of the Maine Retailers Association of the Americas. The trend stands to reason. People are looking for something to do and a safe place to go at a time when the pandemic has raised safety concerns and limited recreational opportunities. Ocean, lakes, and ponds are good places for people to socially distance while having fun at the same time. "I've never seen anything like this," said Rob Soucy from Port Harbor, Maine, which describes itself as Maine's biggest boat dealer. "Since the end of April, we've seen boat sales at historic levels." At one point, his inquiries were up 300 to 400%, and he expects to sell about 1,000 boats this year, a couple hundred more than usual. "It's like wildfire. People are searching for ways to get on the water," said Tracy Coughlin from the Yarmouth Boat Yard, also in Maine. "Sales are up 65% at Yarmouth Boat Yard and a sister company, Moose Landing Marina in Naples, Maine," she said. "The single biggest month for sales growth was June, when sales increased 85%. Boats, of course, come in all sizes and shapes and prices. A new aluminum fishing boat with an outboard engine might cost $10,500, while a 44-foot, 13-meter cruiser would cost up to $900,000, and the prices go up from there. But with vacation travel canceled and other activities on hold, people are ready to escape on the water, on everything from modest boats to luxury yachts, said Chris DeMilo from DeMilo's Yacht Sales in Portland. Our inventory and the market in general is as thin as I've seen. We're getting calls from people who said they never buy a boat. Now they're buying boats, he said. In Southern California, sales are up 40 to 50% at Marina Del Rey Yacht Sales near Los Angeles in the Long Beach Yacht Center, said owner Steve Curran. I've been in the business for 50 years, so I've seen lots of up and downs. I certainly was not expecting this, he said. In Florida, salesman Bill Aston said sales were up more than 200% over the past 2 months at Central Marine Boat Sales in St. Petersburg. We're selling everything we've got. We've run out of product, said Aston, who reports that 95% of his older inventory has been sold. But with all the new boaters taking to the high seas, there are safety concerns that don't directly stem from the coronavirus. The U.S. Coast Guard recommends safety courses for new boaters, but hands-on instruction has been hard to find this summer because of the pandemic, of course. Some boaters have discovered online safety courses. We want people to be out on the water enjoying themselves, but everyone has to take into account safety, said Chris Edmonston, president of Boat U.S. Foundation for Boating Safety and Clean Water in Annapolis, Maryland. Sailing or motoring around on the water represents a nice consolation prize for people who canceled vacations or missed summer camps, athletic programs, or the myriad of other canceled events. Boating allows families to get away from home, remove masks, and enjoy themselves. Mitchell said he and his wife, Hillary, work full-time. They're also raising kids ages 9, 8, and 2, so a boat hadn't been a priority. But the pandemic readjusted the Cape Elizabeth, Maine family's priorities. Even as the economy reopens, the family avoids restaurants and going out. The pre-owned boat, which the family picked up on Friday at Yarmouth, opens a new opportunity to get away, tie up with his brother-in-law's boat, and let the kids play and swim together. They can also explore Maine's mostly uninhabited hundreds of islands. The 26-foot boat, which has a small galley, a head, and a sleeping space, will become a floating oasis from a world in turmoil, Mitchell said. The coronavirus was the catalyst for the decision, he said. This is our family vacation. This is our family road trip, and this is it. And I can tell you from personal experience that there's been a lot of people out boating down on Browns Lake this summer. It's just been packed, but I suppose it's like that a lot of the time. And you are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, July 27th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries, and fortunately there are not too many. First obituary today, and it appears there's only two, is from Sioux City. Dennis Glenn Robinson, Denny Robinson, 72, of Sioux City, died Friday, July 24th at his residence. Memorial service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Thursday at Christy Smith Funeral Home's Morningside, followed by a luncheon at Abu Becker Shrine Temple, 820 Nebraska Street. Visitation will be 4 to 8 p.m. Wednesday with family present 6 to 8 p.m. and a Masonic service at 7 p.m. at Christy Smith Funeral Homes in Morningside at 1801 Morningside Avenue. Denny Robinson, the son of Robert and LaVon Bonnie Hatch Robinson, was born August 14, 1947 in Correctionville. He graduated from East High School in Sioux City in 1967. Denny entered the U.S. Army on July 2, 1967. He attended ordnance training at Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland. Denny was then stationed at the DMZ in Korea during the Vietnam War. On February 8, 1969, Denny was united in marriage with his high school sweetheart, Rebecca S. Becky Johnson, in Sioux City. He was then transferred to Fort Hood in Killeen, Texas, where he served the remainder of his tour. Denny was honorably discharged on July 3, 1970. The couple returned to Sioux City, where Denny was employed as a fabricator at McCracken Concrete Pipe Company. He retired in 1998. Denny was an avid scouter and was affiliated with Troop 221. He was Wood Badge trained, received the Silver Beaver Award, and was a vigil member in the Order of the Arrow. Denny was also a member of the Morningside Masonic Lodge 615, the 32nd degree of the Sioux City Scottish Rite, and the Morningside American Legion Post 697. Denny is survived by his wife, Becky of Sioux City, and his children. The family has requested that memorials be directed to the American Legion Post number 697. And the final and second obituary this morning, just a notice, is from Sioux City. It's Stephen Craig Ashley, A-S-H-L-E-Y, 57, died Thursday, July 23rd. Visitation will be tomorrow, July 28th, from 11 to 1 at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Graveside services will also be tomorrow, July 28th at 2 p.m., 2:30 p.m., at Oak Hill Cemetery in Anthem. On a wider scope, Oscar-winning actress Olivia de Havilland dies at age 104. Dateline Paris, Olivia de Havilland, the doe-eyed actress beloved by millions as the sainted McClanny Wilkes of Gone with the Wind, but also a two-time Oscar winner and an off-screen fighter who challenged and unchained Hollywood's contract system, died Sunday at her home in Paris. She was 104. De Havilland, the sister of fellow Oscar winner Joan Fontaine, died peacefully of natural causes, said New York-based publicist Lisa Goldberg. De Havilland was among the last of the top screen performers from the studio era and the last surviving lead from Gone with the Wind, an irony, she once noted, since the fragile, self-sacrificing Melanie Wilkes was the only major character to die in the film. The 1939 epic, based on Margaret Mitchell's best-selling Civil War novel and winner of 10 Academy Awards, is often ranked as Hollywood's box office champion, adjusting for inflation, although it is now widely criticized for its glorified portrayal of slavery and antebellum life. The pinnacle of producer David O. Selznick's career, the movie had a troubled off-screen story. Three directors worked on the film. Stars Vivian Leigh and Clark Gable were far more connected on screen than off, and the fourth featured performer, Leslie Howard, was indifferent to the role of Ashley Wilkes, Melanie's husband. But de Havilland remembered the movie as one of the happiest experiences I've ever had in my life. It was doing something I wanted to do, playing a character I loved and liked. During a career that spanned six decades, de Havilland also took on roles ranging from an unwed mother to a psychiatric inmate in The Snake Pit, a personal favorite. The dark-haired de Havilland projected both a gentle, glowing warmth and a sense of resilience and mischief that made her uncommonly appealing. She was Errol Flynn's co-star in a series of dramas, westerns, and period pieces, most memorably as Maid Marian in The Adventures of Robin Hood. But de Havilland was also a prototype for an actress too beautiful for her own good, typecast in sweet and romantic roles while desiring greater challenges. Her frustration finally led her to sue Warner Brothers in 1943, when the studio tried to keep her under contract after it had expired, claiming she owed six more months because she had been suspended for refusing roles. Her friend Betty Davis was among those who had failed to get out of her contract under similar conditions in the 1930s, but de Havilland prevailed, with the California Court of Appeals ruling that no studio could extend an agreement without the performer's consent. The decision is still unofficially called de Havilland's Law. De Havilland went on to earn her own Academy Award in 1946 for her performance in To Each His Own, a melodrama about an out-of-wedlock birth. A second Oscar came 3 years later for The Heiress, in which she portrayed a plain young homebody opposite Montgomery Clift and Sir Ralph Richardson in an adaptation of Henry James' Washington Square. In 2008, de Havilland received the National Medal of Arts and was awarded France's Legion of Honor 2 years later. She was also famous, not always for the better, as a sister of Fontaine, with whom she had a troubled relationship, that the deeply private de Havilland refused to discuss until after Fontaine's death in 2013. In a rare 2016 interview with the Associated Press, de Havilland referred to her late sister as the Dragon Lady and said her memories of Fontaine were multifaceted, varying from endearing to alienating. De Havilland once observed that Melanie Wilkes' happiness was sustained by a loving, secure family, a blessing that often eluded de Havilland herself. She was born in Tokyo on July 1, 1916, the daughter of a British patent attorney. Her parents separated when she was three, and her mother brought her and her younger sister Joan to Saratoga, California. De Havilland's own two marriages to Marcus Goodrich and Pierre Gallant ended in divorce. She had lived in Paris since 1953. In her interview with the AP at her luxurious Paris residence in 2016, as she celebrated her 100th birthday, she said she moved to the City of Light at the insistence of Gallant, her late French former husband, and found no reason to return to the U.S. De Havilland's acting ambitions dated back to stage performing at Mills College in Oakland, California. While preparing for a school production of A Midsummer Night's Dream, she went to Hollywood to see Max Reinhardt's rehearsals of the same comedy. She was asked to read for Hernia's understudy, staying with the production through the summer vacation, was given the role in the fall. Warner Brothers wanted stage actors for their lavish 1934 production and chose de Havilland to co-star with Mickey Rooney, who played Puck. "I wanted to be a stage actress," she recalled. "Life sort of made the decision for me." She signed a 5-year contract with the studio and went on to make Captain Blood, Dodge City, and other films with Flynn, a hopeless womanizer even by Hollywood standards. Well, Errol had such magnetism, there was nobody who did what he did better than he did, said de Havilland, whose bond with the dashing actor remained, she would insist, platonic. She is survived by her daughter, Yest Gallant, Chaluk, and son-in-law and niece. Goldberg said private funeral arrangements are being made. Back down to stories inside the journal. Page A3, the Grandview Park band shell has been spray painted again, and police have no suspects. The Grandview Park band shell was targeted with graffiti again this weekend, just a month after a similar incident of vandalism. Sioux City Police Sergeant Jeremy McClure said the band shell was spray painted either Saturday night or Sunday morning. The department had not made any arrests and did not have any suspects as of Sunday evening. Phrases visible on the band shell Sunday included "no justice, no peace," a protest expression commonly seen after incidents of police misconduct, as well as the letters FTP, an abbreviation for an obscene anti-police phrase. By Sunday evening, it appeared as though a partial cleanup job had begun, either by painting over the graffiti or possibly power washing the structure, as the graffiti was considerably fainter than it appeared earlier in the day. Just a month ago, on June 25th, Sioux City police arrested a Sioux City man in connection with a vandalism incident at the band shell that was much the same as the one this weekend. The suspect in the June vandalism case, 23-year-old Esteban Avila, was found in Grandview Park in the early morning hours of June 25th and was charged with criminal mischief and meth-related charges. City crews had cleaned up the band shell, a 1930s structure listed on the National Register of Historic Places, later that same day after the June vandalism. McClure encouraged anyone with information on the vandalism to contact the Sioux City Police Department. In a COVID-19 virus story, Woodbury County leads Northwest Iowa in COVID-19 antibody tests. More people have tested positive for COVID-19 antibodies in Woodbury County than in all other counties in the Northwest Iowa area combined. A total of 108 people in the county have tested positive for antibodies for the novel coronavirus as of Sunday evening, according to data from the Iowa Department of Public Health. Woodbury also leads in the region on positive COVID-19 tests. In Sioux County, which has the second highest antibody tally in the region, 39 people reportedly have them. In Plymouth County, 19 people also do, followed by 13 in Dickinson, and the other counties in the region each have fewer than 10. In Buena Vista County, which has the second highest tally of known COVID-19 infections in the region, Only two have tested positive recently for antibodies. Antibody tests work somewhat differently than tests for the novel coronavirus itself. Blood is drawn for an antibody test to determine if antibodies, agents in the blood thought to protect against the future infections, are present. The test for the virus, usually taken via a swab through the nose, determines whether the individual has the virus presently in their system. The presence of COVID-19 antibodies likely means a person either had or presently has the virus in their system. Testing for antibodies is commonly a voluntary undertaking by those who are concerned or curious about whether they were infected. Some may have had a mild illness, but never tested for the novel coronavirus earlier. A CDC-supported study published by the Journal of American Medical Association on Internal Medicine found that, based on antibody data, many more people likely had the novel coronavirus than was known officially. Many of those who tested positive for the antibodies had only a very mild illness, or none at all, and were never tested for the virus itself during the course of their infections. Antibodies are generally a marker of immunity against a pathogen, although the authors of the JAMA study cautioned that this hasn't yet been established with COVID-19. At present, the relationship between the detectable antibodies to SARS-CoV-2 and protective immunity against future infection is not known, the authors wrote. SARS-CoV-2 is a name for the novel coronavirus, not often used in common parlance, but used by the medical community. The Siouxland District Health Department reported another 10 positive virus tests in Woodbury County on Sunday out of a total of 113 conducted for a positivity rate of 8.8%. Since the beginning of the outbreak more than 4 months ago, a total of 3,540 people in Woodbury County have tested positive, according to the IDPH data as of Sunday evening. Daily coronavirus data from the Iowa Department of Public Health is usually somewhat out of sync with the Siouxland District Health daily reporting. Of the county's total known infections, a total of 3,181, or almost 90%, are now considered recovered. The percentage of recoveries in the county has sagged somewhat in recent weeks as more people have tested positive. An additional COVID-19 death was recorded this weekend in Plymouth County, bringing the death toll there to 7. Most counties in northwest Iowa and southeast South Dakota recorded less than 10 new coronavirus infections this past weekend, except for O'Brien and Sac, which tallied none. The Health Department of Dakota County does not report new coronavirus infections over the weekend, and neither does the Northeast Nebraska Public Health Department, which represents the counties of Cedar, Dixon, Thurston, and Wayne. And Sioux City Northside street work is planned. An estimated week-long closure of 39th Street is planned to begin Monday. The City of Sioux City Engineering Division, in a Friday release, announced the closure of 39th Street for paving repairs between Pierce and Jackson Streets. The work is slated to begin Monday morning, that's today, and be completed by August 3rd, weather permitting. A detour route utilizing Pierce Street, 38th Street, and Jackson Street will be available during this closure. We have time for a sports story of local interest, and this is about the Sergeant Bluff Luton Warriors, who are playing in the state baseball tournament. And the headline of the story is, "Locking Down the Field, the Warriors' Defense is Among the Best in Iowa." When Sergeant Bluff Luton High School senior Daniel Wright walks to the mound, he doesn't have to worry about his teammates behind him. He has confidence in his defense. The Warriors' defense is one of the best in the state, which allows the pitching staff to feel more comfortable. SBL's defense ranks among one of the best in the entire state, as the Warriors have committed just 18 errors all season. Those 18 errors are the third fewest in all of Iowa, only trailing Remsen St. Mary's with 11 and Fort Madison with 12. SBL has two starters who haven't committed an error all season, Daniel Wright, the pitcher, and who pitches also and plays first base, and Sean Owens. The Warriors are now 20-3 and will use that defense at the state tournament at 1:30 p.m. Tuesday against Marion at Principal Park in Des Moines. SBL holds the number one seed in the Class 3A field, and the Indians from Marion have the eighth seed. Warriors coach Matt Nelson tells his players to fine-tune the little things, and the players have taken that to heart throughout the entire season. We're not going to try to let our other teams beat us by us beating ourselves, Nelson said. So every day at practice, our infielders take ground balls. I mean, every day our outfielders are doing some type of outfield work. So it's something that we focus on a lot. And pitching and defense keeps us in ball games, and they've done a tremendous job. Even guys who maybe have had errors in the past that really, really hunkered down and become really good. Not just offensive players, but defensive side too. There's not a practice that goes by where the Warriors infield doesn't take ground balls and the outfield doesn't take fly balls. Nelson admitted that the team didn't work that much on defensive drills even before the quarantine started due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Nelson credited the team, however, with being athletic and mentally strong to avoid making errors on a regular basis. Experience helped with that, too. Many of these Warriors have played at the varsity level since they were freshmen and sophomores. Among young players to come up through the ranks, Nelson knew the mistakes would happen, but enjoyed to see them blossom into the state's third-best team. When you're younger, it's tough, Nelson said. You've got the nerves going a little bit. You haven't been in a situation, and you don't know ideally what to do with your pre-pitch approach, or maybe being ready and knowing what you're going to do with the ball if it comes to you. When you have guys like we do, they know what they're supposed to do, and then they can actually go through the process of executing it. So I'm happy for the year that a lot of them have had defensively. One of the players Nelson thought what had improved over time has been senior second baseman Trevor Stoltz. Stoltz has been the Warriors' full-time second baseman for 2 seasons, and both Nelson and Stoltz agreed that Stoltz had gotten comfortable toward the end of last season. Stoltz admitted there were nerves last year as a first-time starting varsity second baseman. But with getting experience in games and getting several repetitions during practice, he's much more comfortable. The ground balls are a lot different from JV to varsity, Stoltz said. I would say experience is the biggest factor. The more practice, the better. As a senior, I'm a lot more relaxed. I didn't come in blindfolded. I knew what to expect. Stoltz is one of the many who isn't afraid to have a ball hit to him. For example, Stoltz was the one to field the ground ball that ended Spencer's seventh-inning rally last week in the sub-state semifinals. Stoltz anticipated the ball coming to him, and when the ball did, he took a knee, fielded it cleanly, and threw over to Wright, who played first base that night. When Stoltz sees a grounder coming his way, he doesn't take time to think about what could happen. He's built up enough muscle memory that he tries to field each ground ball correctly. You have to be ready at all times, Stoltz said. While Stoltz's play may not make the highlight reels, it is plays like those that make the pitchers confident about the defense. It's just a really comfortable feeling, honestly, Wright said. Those same guys have been in the same position since we were 10, 11 years old. I turn around, I see Derek Fitzgerald and Trevor up the middle, and I know they're going to get the job done. Jacob Massey at the hot corner, I know he's going to get the job done. Nelson also credited Massey as making strides this year at third base. Massey has committed just 2 errors all season. The Iowa Central baseball commit had 20 errors in 2019. I know that was something in the end of the offseason he was really irritated, Nelson said. Owens, meanwhile, didn't go out for a winter sport so that he could lose about 20 pounds and be ready for the baseball season. Nelson remembered when Owens visited Nelson's classroom and after the football season to talk to him about his plans. He was a key contributor for the offense and defense on the line for our dome-bound football team, Nelson said. I had him in class who was just like, I'm going to be in better shape. I'm going to be a faster, more flexible, more agile runner, hitter, and a fielder. And it showed. This is the 5th time the Warriors have clinched a state tournament berth, but they haven't won a state title in those visits. SBL's last time to state was in 2015. Getting to state was a big talking point in the offseason, and Nelson knew being number one in the Missouri River Conference and the sub-state was a goal. They accomplished that along with clinching the number one seed in the state. I think they feel that maybe our side of the state it's not much recognized, or maybe not as respected as the teams ought to be. sometimes Nelson said. They might be the number one seed, but I still kind of feel like they have this a little bit of this underdog approach. This, we're still trying to prove some things here. The Warriors realize that even though Marion is the eighth seed, they're not an underdog by any means. This also is the Indians' fifth trip to state. We just have to keep doing what we've been doing, Wright said. We have to keep finding ways with any way we can. We'll be all hands on deck, and I'm excited to see everyone contribute the same way they did Wednesday night. And retailers that resisted masks now relent. When the parent of Southern grocery chain Winn-Dixie said that it wasn't going to require customers to wear masks to protect against the spread of the coronavirus, the response was brutal, with some loyal patrons vowing on social media never to shop there again. Days later, Winn-Dixie reversed course and said that it would mandate masks in states or localities that had no requirement. That about-face on Monday followed another highly publicized reversal last month by AMC. Less than a day after the nation's largest movie theater chain said it would defer to local governments on whether masks should be worn, it came up with a new message in response to social media backlash. Customers who don't wear masks won't be admitted or allowed to stay. Even as pockets of resistance remain, the tide appears to be turning on masks. Three out of four Americans favor requiring people to wear face coverings while outside their homes, according to a survey by the Associated Press, NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. Even President Donald Trump changed his stance after months of downplaying the importance of masks and insisting that it was a Democrat hoax on the whole pandemic issue. Whether you like the mask or not, they have an impact, he said last week. As the number of new virus cases surged in a slew of states, particularly Florida, Texas, California, and Arizona, national chains like Walmart, Target, and most recently McDonald's are issuing mask mandates as health officials repeatedly advise that covering your nose and mouth can be one of the most effective ways to reduce infections, itself a reversal of earlier messaging at the beginning of the pandemic. I believe brands need to pay attention to the new consumer activist, said Stefan Pollack, president of his own Los Angeles-based public relations and marketing company. Brands no longer have the luxury of staying neutral. Leslie Fay, 56, a service coordinator for an aging home services company, said she was about to boycott Winn-Dixie when she heard about its initial decision to not require masks. It set me off in the wrong direction to know that they were disregarding their employees and customers, said the Clearwater, Florida resident. I'm glad they reversed it. Southeastern Grocers, parent company of Winn-Dixie, said that it initially rejected a mask mandate because it didn't want to put its workers in the position of policing shoppers. Winn-Dixie's 500 stores are located in Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, and Georgia, in addition to Florida, all states that are grappling with rising coronavirus cases and have all foolishly not required masks. We know masks play an important role in stopping the spread of the virus, and we updated our policy to reflect that, said Joe Caldwell, a spokesman for Southeastern. AMC Theaters CEO Adam Aron said last month that the response that we did not go far enough in the usage of our masks. And to require them more would be something that must be required. These retailers are finding they must be sensitive to the prevailing sentiment in their regions, and plenty of resistance from shoppers remains, with viral videos of mask rule defiers continuing to surface on social media. There has been a trend that has switched in favor of wearing masks, said Neil Saunders, managing director of Global Data Retail, but there are people whose minds will still not be changed by this. It's easy to put a policy in place, but it's much harder to enforce it when you have your workers on the front lines. In fact, the parent of Dollar Tree and Family Dollar went in the opposite direction, loosening its mask restrictions. It initially started mandating shoppers wear masks among the suppliers and employees, but then changed its policy last week to request face coverings in stores where there are no state or local mandates. A Dollar Tree Inc. spokesman didn't respond to emails, but Saunders believes the company realized its bare-bones staff wouldn't be enough to police the rules. Others think that it wanted to siphon away anti-mask customers from Walmart and others. Almost 7 out of 10 grocery workers said their employers are not enforcing mask mandates in the stores, according to a survey of 4,000 grocery workers between June 22nd and June 26th by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union International, which represents grocery workers and meat packers, among others. Well, that brings us to the end of the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Monday, July 27th, 2020. I'm your substitute reader, Alan Fredericksen. Barb Knepper will be back next Monday. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.